The little boy said, mommy puts her cigarettes out on my arm. And then he paused and he said, but only when I'm bad.
If you see multiple cigarette burns, if he says she only does it when I'm bad, that means it is repeat behavior.
It's obvious that we look at the parents when a child of six or really of any age goes missing.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello, and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer for CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Hi, everybody. Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor and current senior producer on America's Most Wanted. And we have a really special guest today, right, Jim?
Yes, we do.
Hi, it's Bobby Chacon. I'm back again.
Bobby Chacon. I love the way he just says, I'm back again, because he knows pretty much our entire listening panel knows who he is.
And I hope so. I've been on the show enough.
Give us your priors in a nutshell, Bobby.
27-year FBI agent. And like both of you, I graduated law school many years ago and went into the FBI after law school and then spent the next 27 years, about half of New York and a little less than half in LA. My two offices, I did some overseas assignments. I did a variety of violations. Those in the FBI, the crime that you're assigned to investigate is called your violation. You say that's the violation. So the violation of law that each squad is specified to go after. So I did many different violations, mainly on the criminal, what we call the criminal side of the house. The FBI has obviously several houses. It's the intelligence side of the house. Now we have a big counterterrorism side.
I think this is going way beyond nutshell, don't you?
No,
Frankie?
It isn't. I love it. It's perfect, Jim.
I'm just wondering. Look at this.
How big the nut is.
I think Bobby is really pushing this episode into uncharted
territory.
Size of
the shell, Jim, depends on the size of nuts.
Okay. I think we're going way off track here. So maybe I'm going to pull us back into a little bit of normalcy and just say Bobby had a long and distinguished career.
Yeah.
And
Bobby, did you by any chance just leave the dentist office after getting some of that laughing gas kind of stuff?
I think we're just going to start with this, Jim. But I'm hoping that Bobby Chacon has a case to talk to us about, Jim. So I think we should dive right into our
question.
Let's dive in. Did you see what I did there, Bobby?
I did see
dive
that.
In. So wow. See, he's not the only funny one on the call. Anyway, so Bobby, tell us where you were in your career when the case you're going to talk about today came in.
Well, in my career, I was in about 7 or 8 years as an FBI agent. So I had seen a lot. I had seen, gang slayings. I was working RICO cases in Brooklyn. I had seen the mob wars of the late 80s and early 90s in New York City. So I thought I was, getting pretty grizzled, I would guess. But then I started on the dive team at about that time. And my very first case on the dive team, we had to go out to a rural area in Midwest, and it was a, and you and Jim obviously can appreciate this. It was a case of severe child abuse by the parents. The little boy was 6 years old, went missing. The parents were suspected. I remember this detail about the case, and it didn't really matter to me as a diver, but we got briefed on the case by the case agents when we first got there, and the school nurse.
Where was this, Bobby? Where in the country?
It was in West Virginia.
West Virginia.
And it was near the border of Pennsylvania. I just remember the case agent telling us that part of the abuse was the little boy had cigarette burns on his arm, and when he went to the school nurse, because one of the teacher had seen it or something. the little boy said, mommy puts her cigarettes out on my arm. But and then he paused and he said, but only when I'm bad. And so, you know, he didn't know that was abuse, right? He thought it was justified that mommy does this because I'm bad. That's why it's happening, you know? Yeah. You know, and so we were tasked because what the agents had done was this couple were local people there. They had never lived anywhere else or moved anywhere else. Their jobs did not require them to travel. But, you know, about a week, maybe less than a week after, the boy has not been seen in school or by his neighbors who are his cousins. And they played together every day. Several days after that, the father rents a car and returns it a day or two later. His explanation did not really add up as to why he rented a car. And so what the agents did, which is, you know, normal part of investigation, you get the mileage in, the mileage out, you realize how much he had driven that car during the rental period. And when you do a worst, you know, case scenario, you go, okay, he could have gone this far out and used enough to get back, right? So you do an out and back type of thing. And then you draw a circle around where the rental car was rented from. And, you know, that's your general area that if he used that car to dispose of that child's body, you know, it's most likely in that circle. And so you start looking what's in that circle. So they were, you know, they had teams out, you know, ERT teams and community search teams out in the woods, you know, doing the traditional, you know, hand-to-hand search. And then there were several, actually quite a lot of old abandoned quarries. It was kind of a mining area of West Virginia, the quarries, the way they quarry mining. When a quarry is done, they usually drill down into it and then it fills up. It's a lake of water and it fills up with water. It becomes a lake. Sometimes they become recreational areas or whatever. And so there were, you know, several smaller and larger quarries in the area that we started diving in. And
aren't those pretty deep usually?
Yeah. Yeah.
And cold.
Yeah. And there's a famous one called Dutch Springs in Pennsylvania that has, like, it's now a diving facility, diving training facility. They have a helicopter down there. They have a school bus down there. Wow. And you dive and you can practice kind of, you know, penetrating into these things to get, you know, if someone's trapped in a school bus, you can figure out how you get them out and things like that. So it's a huge training facility. So there were some shallower, I remember there was some shallower quarries. And I remember there was one that I think what they did was they started it as a quarry, but they dug and they didn't find the whatever mineral that they was supposed to there. So they abandoned it. So it was not that deep. It was maybe 20 feet deep. But what happened was vegetation started growing. So you're standing on the bottom of basically a almost like a huge concrete swimming pool, but it's like limestone. But now vegetation has grown up all the way to the surface. And so you're in this forest, you're sitting there and the forest is about 20 feet high and you're kind of cutting your way through trying to, you know, work your way through a search pattern if you can.
Aren't you worried about like trees and branches ripping off hoses and doing things?
Yeah, I mean, we always tried to be as streamlined as possible with our gear so that nothing got tangled. And then, so in a situation like that, normally you're side by side with your diving partner. But in that case, my diving partner was above me because, you know, she wanted that day. I remember it was Brenda. She wanted to stay out of the thickness of it. You know, so I was using my knife to keep cutting, and I would thrust my hands in front of myself to, you know, to search about 3 feet at a time, my arm length, and see, you know, what was in there. And you know, when we've seen now pictures of the little boy and things like that, and you start realizing every branch or every thick vine feels like a child's finger. Because it's pitch black and it was one of my first jobs. It was certainly my first recovery. And so I almost didn't want to find it, you know, so you're kind of sticking it and you're kind of like,
how did you want to find? I don't know how you ever go down.
So every
like want to find it.
I would grab a twig and think it feels like a finger. And then I would snap it and then pull it towards myself. And then I realize it's a stick or whatever. And then at one point I reach in, I feel a bag and I pull it towards myself and I put it up because it's very dark. And I used my flashlight and then I saw it was a clear plastic bag and I had stuff inside it. And it seemed to be rolled at one end. So I gave it to Brenda, my dive partner above me, and she went to the surface. And then I waited and then she came back and gave me the signal to continue. And I didn't know what was in it till we finished our part of the dive and we came up. And it was, and a couple of other divers found similar bags. And when they unrolled the bags, there were clothes and debris and kind of rocks in some of them, and they were stapled shut.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
But it was later determined those were test bags that the father had used to see if what he threw in the quarry would sink and stay sunk. And they realized that because some of them had junk mail, like they used little different things from the house and they shoved like junk mail into one of them and their address and name was on it. And
so they're not particularly sophisticated.
No, not very, because clearly they don't realize that, you know, that human beings are not the same as junk mail when you put them in water.
Yeah. So we started realizing that from the size of the bags that they were used for these tests, we realized the boy would not fit into these bags unless he wasn't whole.
Come on.
And so we knew.
What pointed you at bodies of water to begin with to even look? I mean, within that radius of the rental car, it could have been any number of places, right?
They put the father on a polygraph and they asked him a series of questions. One question related to water. And we always ask that they do that when you're trying to figure out if the person did something, you know, as a dive team, we always want to know. So they asked him, and every time they asked him a question about water, the fact that he was being deceptive, was a high mark. And so they said, every time we ask him about water, he's being deceptive.
And was it just the father that was polygraphed?
Yeah. No, I think both were polygraphs. But I think what they found out through the investigation was the mother was kind of the dominant one in the relationship. And the father basically did anything the mother said.
I was going to say, because typically we see that women choose water burials over men.
Yeah.
That reminds me of a question that I have for Jim, actually, Bobby, about this. Jim, you know, it's obvious that we look at the parents when a child of 6 or really of any age goes missing. And is that? Aren't there statistics that sort of back that suspicion up?
Yeah, sure. Well, we did the child abduction study. We included false allegations of child abduction. And certainly when a child is of tender years, where they're typically in this tight ring of care and custody of the parents or parental figures, they are typically the most likely offender if there is a false allegation of child abduction. As a child ages and gets into high school, then they're more exposed to acquaintances and strangers. And so you'll see abduction cases leaning that way. But in this case, with a young boy, the parents have to be ruled out right away.
Well, and obviously we've seen rare cases, but we've seen cases of children being kidnapped by strangers. And even like in the case of Elizabeth Smart, the offender breaking into the house and snatching her in the middle of the night.
Yeah,
and
sure.
something similar happened with Polly Klass, who sadly didn't survive. So it's it's possible that when a child goes missing, it's not the parents, but that's certainly always where law enforcement looks first. And polygraphing them makes a lot of sense, especially when you think about them probably saying things to law enforcement during the course of that investigation before Bobby got involved that were inconsistent with each other or inconsistent inside their own statements or just inconsistent with people who did not get rid of their six-year-old.
Well, and the history of abuse, you know, that was documented at least at the school level, you know, is another indication that this little boy may have been abused.
Sorry, Bobby, to interrupt you again. I drive everyone nuts, but I just have to say that is what drives me so crazy about our current system of child protection, Child Protective Services, or CPS, as it's called in most places in the country. It drives me nuts because their overarching message, their rule, their requirement when there's an allegation of child abuse or child neglect is reunification. That is their goal, to reunify the child with the parents, as if any normal functioning person doesn't already understand that putting your cigarette out on your child's arm is physical abuse, but they do it anyway.
How do you not throw that family, at least the mother, in jail immediately?
I don't know.
They often do. They often go to jail, but then they get out years later and they get the kids back and they have more kids and they're allowed to have more kids. And you know, you're right. We don't always treat it with the effect. And, you know, I have a different take on it and working some of these cases, and Jim may disagree with me, but you know, there's a switch or there's a line, you know, and if you can abuse your own child once, you can abuse it again. And I don't care about rehabilitation or whatever. And yeah, I get therapy and all that, but if you have it in your, like, because I think there are some people who couldn't abuse their own child, no matter how frustrated they get, no matter how, no matter how tired, no matter how, you know, whatever. I think that once you cross that line and you abuse your own child in a horrific way, you can always do it again. You know what I mean? And I just think it's one of those things where it's the reason why we see a pattern of behavior. You don't see, you know, a child just hit once and then never happen again. You see it as a pattern of behavior that happens over and over again.
Yeah,
and,
but
and
if, of you course see, multiple children. If you see multiple cigarette burns, if he says she only does it when I'm bad, that means it is repeat behavior.
Right.
That is absolutely enough to lock that mother up. And I can't believe that didn't happen. And it sounds like the horrible things that happened afterwards were even worse.
Well, so Bobby, there you guys are. You're, you know, at the bottom of this former quarry or sort of aborted quarry, and y'all are looking for a child's body. You find these clues that indicate there's maybe something there.
This is a really compelling and difficult story to tell, but we have so much more to talk about. So please come back next week and tell us the conclusion to this really intense search that you're in the middle of. Well, then, till next time, this is Best Case, Worst Case, signing off.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production produced by Francie Hakes, Josh Murphy, and Jim Clementi at Empire Studios LA. Engineered and edited by Matt Gergel. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba and hosted by Wondery.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness to Light can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's D2L.org.